leader, the life story of the foremost man of our time, Winston Churchill. Winston Churchill, no longer a member of the government, living now only the role of ardent critic, has envisioned the drift to war, understands the colossal ambitions which stir Germany and will bestir her into violent life. Returning from Germany, he warns Parliament, only to be laughed at by the wise men of the day. To his wife, Clementine, he bitterly recounts his views.
The cabinet is blind, absolutely blind. Why don't they look beneath the surface and see the iron realities there?
What did you observe, Winston?
I didn't have to look very far to see what's happening inside Germany. Bands of sturdy Teutonic youths with a light in their eyes, a light of desire. The British government believes they are looking for recognition, for sympathetic understanding. Pa! Those German youths are looking for weapons.
If you speak in those terms in the House, there'll be an outcry from the government benches.
I'm used to outcries whenever I speak my mind. We're fast approaching the parting of the ways, my dear. Once again, I can see a dividing line between myself and the Conservative Party. Once again, I'm going to speak out and tell them what utter fools they are. In face of iron realities, we disarm. We disarm.
The year is 1935, and another dictator, another totalitarian state, has sufficiently strengthened itself to spread tentacles of conquest beyond its borders. The Abyssinian crisis, and Churchill watches with anxious eyes. In the Mediterranean, the British fleet is on guard for a surprise attack by the Italians, for sanctions have been imposed and anything might happen. Talking with a colleague, Brendan Brecken, one day...
Well, Mr. Churchill, the League of Nations has at last justified its existence. On November the 18th, all exports from Italy will cease.
And in the meantime, the war in Africa goes on. The blood of Ethiopians is being shed in sacrifice to the god of Italian power.
But don't you think the application of sanctions should have some effect on Italy?
Gaps will be found, Benton. Be sure of that. If the application of sanctions were complete, general, and loyal, it might produce a definite result. But I've noticed a certain amount of hesitation. Did you read Laval's speech?
Laval? Don't you trust him?
Listen to what he says. My country is loyally applying the covenant, but we have another duty to fulfill. This duty is particularly imperative for France, which on January the 7th last signed a treaty of friendship with Italy. I shall therefore continue my attempt to find elements that might serve as a basis for negotiations. Negotiations? What Laval means, of course, is further appeasement.
But Laval can't do anything else.
He won't be alone. Now listen to what our own foreign minister has to say. I have listened with great sympathy and with full approval to the words uttered by Monsieur Laval. He has accurately expressed what is in the minds of all of us. On the one hand, as loyal members of the League, we feel it our bounden duty to carry out our obligations and undertake the duty imposed on us by the Covenant. On the other hand, we are under no less insistent obligations to strive for a speedy and honorable settlement of the controversy.
Someone ought to quote Laval and Hoare, the passage in the Bible about not being able to serve two masters.
There's something in the wind, my boy. Let me quote Sir Samuel further. It's common talk that during the last few days, there have been conversations taking place between Rome, Paris, and London on the possibilities of such a settlement. There is nothing mysterious or sinister about these discussions. You hear that, Brendan?
Methinks the lady doth protest too much.
Exactly. Who suggested that there was anything mysterious or sinister about the discussions? It savors of anticipation to me.
They wouldn't dare stab the League in the back.
I wouldn't trust these disciples of appeasement an inch, Brendan. Mark my words, Laval and Hoare are up to something. And when it comes out, we shall see just how much they believe in collective security.
Mr. Churchill, have you read this article by Pertinax?
I haven't got time to read anything. Besides, I'm very busy just now.
It's rather important, and we'd like your opinion on it.
Well, 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 what has Pertinax got to say this time?
He says that Sir Samuel Hall and Monsieur Laval have agreed on a peace plan.
What?
The plan, according to Pertinax, is that Italy should be given nearly half of Ethiopia.
I don't believe it. It's unthinkable.
I've already been to the Foreign Office, but they won't give me any satisfaction.
Didn't they deny it?
No, they certainly didn't deny it, Mr. Churchill. They were rather evasive, I thought.
Let me see that article.
There. It's an official translation.
Cession to Italy of the Dnakil for the Eastern Tigre. The territory south of latitude 8 and west to longitude 36. Pass me that atlas. Look, the top shelf there. Yes. Well, open it at North Africa. Economic rights. Ownership of unoccupied land. Monopoly of mines and forests. Good heavens, this can't be true.
Here's the map of Abyssinia, Mr. Churchill.
Yes, well, let me see now. Latitude 8. Yes. Longitude 36.
There it is.
But this is monstrous if it's true. Oh, that's impossible. No British foreign minister could be capable of such a thing.
Pertinax says his authorities are absolutely reliable. They usually are.
I wouldn't be surprised at anything Laval concocted. He's lost both his faces long ago. But Sir Samuel Hoare, no, I won't believe it.
The general feeling seems to be that the government was afraid of the oil sanctions. If applied, might force Italy into declaring war. It's been known for some time the conversations were taking place.
Conversations? If this thing is true, it means that a premium has been placed on aggression. It means that henceforth, not a small nation in Europe is safe.
Can I quote that?
Certainly not. We don't even know whether this report has a grain of truth in it. If it has, you can quote me as saying that Hoare and Laval have given democracy the greatest and most treacherous blow it has ever suffered.
Gentlemen, in introducing our principal speaker, there's no need for me to elaborate on his record. For years now, he's been ceaselessly urging the government to give up their foolish policy of appeasement. Gentlemen, the man of the hour, Mr. Winston Churchill.
Mr. Chairman and gentlemen, for years now, I have talked to the members of the House of Commons, warning them, not with very great success, of the perils ahead. I have watched this famous island descending incontinently, recklessly, the stairway which leads to a dark gulf. It is a fine broad stairway at the beginning, but after a bit, the carpet ends. A little farther on, there are only flagstones, and a little farther on still, these break beneath your feet. Mr. Baldwin's Volteface over the Hall of our peace proposals have taken us into even lower depths. But Mr. Baldwin has emerged, if not triumphant, at least safe. He mutters with a smirk, "You know, you can still trust me." But can we?
No.
I am compelled to agree. A scapegoat has been found. Sir Samuel Hoare has resigned. His reasons were unconvincing, but sincere. But Mr. Baldwin's speech left only an impression of shuffling evasion. He said that Sir Samuel had been exhausted and half ill when he conferred with Laval. He spoke on the absence of liaison during the conference. But the truth lies deeper. Are we to believe that the government would let a foreign secretary go off for a weekend to Paris and invent a plan, or help to invent one, wholly on his own initiative?
Oh.
Clementine blind. And it's their blindness which is to make others suffer. Have they forgotten 1914? More have they forgotten 1918? You remember, we waited for the clock to strike 11.
Yes, I can remember as though it were yesterday.
Our country has emerged from the ordeal alive and well. Its vast possessions intact, its war effort not waning but waxing, its institutions unshaken, its people and empire united as never before. Hazards and heartbreaks, and now victory.
It's almost time.
Yes. Just a few minutes to 11, and then the curtain comes down on this terrible drama, this tragedy of agony. The 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month. To face that all over again, because they won't heed my warnings.
As in the years before 1914, once again the world is drifting to war. Once again history repeats itself. And Winston Churchill stands ready to defy any enemy and to prepare England for the test to come. But this time he is out of office and powerless to act. This time he must watch the spectacle of a swiftly arming Germany and Italy, knowing that war will come, knowing that when it does come, Britain will be unprepared.